Dr. Comparé.
Our Father, again we thank Thee for this opportunity to gather together Thy children in Christian fellowship to study Thy Word. We pray that Thou wilt open our minds and enable us to understand this, for this is prophecies which are beginning to apply to our own day. We pray that Thou wilt put Thy Spirit upon us and guide us through this. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, we're getting to the 10th installment of our study of the book of Revelation. Up to this point, we've covered through Revelation chapter 13, verse 10, the vision of a beast rising out of the sea, and which obviously includes all of the four beasts that Daniel had a vision of, all rolled into one, because he has the characteristics of all four. And then it says that this beast, which had seven heads, one of the heads was wounded with what appeared to be a deadly wound, but that the deadly wound was healed. Now, we checked last time, that particular head, which recovered from the deadly wound, was the Roman Empire, which, of course, came to what appeared to be a complete and permanent end in 476 A.D., and for a period of three centuries stayed dead in chaos. And then, in the year 800, Charlemagne really revived the Roman Empire because he conquered practically all the European territory that had been part of the old Roman Empire and brought it under his individual rule. And he was crowned Emperor of the Romans in the year 800. Then we were told that the dragon, which is that same red dragon that we saw previously, gave his power and throne and authority to this beast. You remember when we were checking up on that dragon? Obviously, satanic. This red dragon stood before the woman Israel to devour her child as soon as it was born. And the child, of course, was Jesus Christ, because it said he was destined to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and that he was caught up to the throne of God in heaven. Now, we know, of course, who it was that was trying to murder the infant Christ, and that was Herod, the Edomite Jew. And as a further identification here, remember that word Edom means red. This red dragon, the Edomite Jew dragon, in other words, the literal children of Satan. Satan operates through his children, just as God operates in this world, much of the time through his children. Now, this beast that John saw rise out of the sea had seven heads and ten horns. And you remember that was true of the dragon also. At this point, Revelation 13, verse 1, it does not state the color of the beast, but we pick it up in a later chapter, obviously the same beast, and find it was a scarlet red beast. In Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 to 3, we're picking up this same beast that we first meet in the 13th chapter. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now, throughout the Bible, waters are symbolic of people. And that's further confirmed here, because the angel telling John about this says that the waters on which the horror sits and rules are peoples, races, nations, and with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Well, the dragon, emblematic of satanic power, it says he gave his power and throne and authority to the beast, and the beast carries the same marks of satanic guidance, these 7 heads and 10 horns. So John said that he looked at this and was astonished and marveled at what he saw. Then Revelation chapter 17, verses 7 to 11. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. Now you come to a portion which has tripped up most of the people who try to interpret the book of Revelation. Of course, mostly it's by people who have been taught the old theory, you must blame everything on the Catholic Church. Presumably the serpent that deceived Adam and Eve was the Pope, and undoubtedly the Catholic Church was to blame for Noah's flood, and all that sort of thing. Now you find things here which cannot possibly be accounted for by the Catholic Church, except that the Catholic Church was a part only of what is described here. Yes, corrupted by the same satanic influence, working for the same satanic purposes as the rest, but it is only one cog in the machine and not the whole thing. The beast thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. So the people who have the everything is the Catholic Church fallacy say, ah, you see, that's the city of Rome, because Rome had 7 hills. But there are at least 4 great world capitals which have 7 hills, as far as that goes, so that doesn't mark out Rome. And this whole thing is obviously tremendously bigger than Rome, either politically or religiously. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, of course, in the Bible, a mountain is the symbol of a nation. And your King James Version says, there are 7 kings. But that's pure mistranslation, because even the marginal notes in your Scofield edition corrects it. The original says, and they, referring to these 7 mountains, are 7 kings. Really, kingdoms would be a more accurate English translation. Now, up to, 300 years ago or less, very few people conceived of the existence of a nation as such. It was simply the territory ruled by a particular king. And whenever he was able, by conquest, to take over other territory, or by marriage, or by inheritance, get other territory, they never considered that to be something distinct. That was always part of his same kingdom. So in speaking of a king, you're speaking here of a monarchy, a nation governed by a king. And they are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. So I have read books full of utter rot. They're all trying to make this simply the Roman Empire, and they speak about five previous rulers of Rome, and then the sixth was living in John's time, and so this must refer here to the next emperor after the death of John, and so on. Pure rot. Nearly everything that you find written about the book of Revelation, you can throw in the ash can without bothering to read it. I have seen one that was surprisingly good by Ferris, an Australian, in two little paperback volumes about a quarter inch thick each. Very condensed. It simply states what happened and will give you a date and no details, and if you want to find out whether it's right, you've got to go look it up in an encyclopedia or history and find out for yourself. But he's right to a surprising degree. So, the seven heads are seven mountains, seven kings, five already fallen when John wrote this, 94 A.D. One is, existed at that time, and the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. Now let's start unscrambling this. Now the beast can't be Rome, because John was told that in his time the beast is not. And of course Rome was just at the apex of its empire in John's time. It can't be the Catholic Church because that didn't come into existence for some centuries after John wrote. The beast is scarlet, another tip-off that it's Edomite Jew ruled, and obviously satanic. So you can't say that its heads are individual Roman emperors. They are great empires. Now, Daniel got a vision of only four world empires, beginning with Babylon, which was the great world empire in his own lifetime. Then Medo-Persia, Alexander's empire, and Rome. Now, no review of past history was intended in the book of Daniel, and therefore it spoke of nothing prior to Babylon. And it didn't go beyond Rome because that particular vision was not intended to go clear to the time of the end. Now let's see if we can pick up seven great world empires. Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, Medo-Persia, and Alexander's empire. That's five, which had fallen in John's time. You remember Alexander died, what was it, 323 or something like that, B.C. One is, that's the Roman Empire, and for a long time, no other. So you can see, these, none of them are petty kingdoms. They are all empires which ruled pretty much all the world they knew in their day. And so the seventh, which had not yet come, has to be of the same kind. Well, from the time of the fall of Rome, and by the way, for the last century of that, the empire was not ruled from the city of Rome anyway. It was ruled from either Ravenna or Milan for the last century before the total breakup in 476. You did have, of course, a really Grecian Empire still clinging to the name of Roman Empire in the east under Constantinople, but gradually fizzling out and to be finally conquered by the Saracens and the Turks. But in Europe, where John's visions apply, in Europe you had simply a vacuum. You had a multitude of petty little city-states fighting constantly among themselves, and none of them able to keep order. Then in 800, you had Charlemagne establishing an empire, and he was crowned by the Pope as King of the Romans, an attempt to reestablish the Roman Empire. Now, of course, if you would had to live your lifetime in a period of 3 centuries of utter anarchy, why, probably you'd view with some relief the idea of restoring an authoritative rule. Well, that fizzled out, about a century, I think it was, until it came to an end, under Charles the Bald and Charles the Fat. Their only distinguishing characteristics. So then you had a gap. For some little time, well, until 962, when the German king, Otho, was asked to take over and rule, and he was again crowned by the Pope, and it was called the Holy Roman Empire. Well, it was ruled usually from Austria, always a Germanic king. And to a certain extent, it maintained order, not to the extent the previous empires had done. It wasn't as tyrannical, but empire after a fashion. But you had a gap in there now, a long gap, before anything showed up. Certainly nothing that could be called a seventh empire equal to the previous six. Then there appeared on the scene Napoleon Bonaparte. He was a French army officer from 1785. He continued in the service after the French Revolution in 1793. Unquestionably a very brilliant officer. His strategy was so much better than that of any competitor that he almost never lost a battle till it came to Waterloo. So he was promoted rapidly in the revolutionary communist French government. Well, it of course was a mess of stupid and incompetent theoreticians who couldn't adapt their theories to reality, and it bogged down worse and worse in the idiocy that socialism always is. And finally, in 1799, by a swift military coup d'etat, Napoleon overthrew this old government. They established a new government, governed by a triumvirate who were called consuls, but the other two were non-entities. Napoleon was the head of it, and in August 1802, he was made consul for life, and May 1804, he proclaimed himself emperor of the French. So the Pope thought, well, now here again I will say the crown is mine to give or withhold as I choose, and he has it only by my sufferance. Well, Napoleon told the Pope to come there to the coronation. When the Pope stepped up holding the crown, Napoleon took it out of his hands and put it on his own head, that there might be no doubt as to the source of the authority. So the year 1804 begins Napoleon's empire. Now let's take a look at what he did in this very short space that was allotted to him. Before that, under the old communist government, Spain had been pretty well conquered. So when he took over in 1804, he was already King of France, he was master of Spain, and he was proclaimed King of Italy in 1805. He conquered Austria that same year, 1805, and the King of Austria, the following year, 1806, gave up his title of Holy Roman Emperor. Actually, for a century at least, it had been an empty title with no power. 1806, Napoleon conquered the German state of Prussia. Remember, there was no nation of Germany, but a number of small German states, and Prussia was the only one large enough to give him any real opposition. So you can say he took over all of Germany with that. In 1807, he defeated the forces of Russia in Eastern Europe. They were coming in there to try to battle him. So the Russians, whom he had defeated, formed an alliance with him then, which lasts about as long as most Russian alliances, just until an opportunity to break it. In 1808, he conquered Sweden, and remember, at that time, Sweden ruled Norway also. And, of course, he had, in the meantime, taken over Belgium, Holland, Denmark, and so on. So by 1808, he was the master of the entire continent of Europe, leaving only England against him. Now, when you get into the Balkan states, to the extent that they were not under Turkish rule, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, then called Bohemia, and that sort of thing, these were all under the domination of Austrian or Germanic kings, so those were taken as part of his conquering of the main nations. In 1809, he annexed the Papal States. During the period of anarchy, between the fall of Rome and Charlemagne taking over, the Pope had expanded his power until he ruled, you might say, the central third of the Italian peninsula. And later, under the more powerful kings of the restored empire, he was given additional bits and tatters of territory. So he had fully a third of all Italy as the Papal States. So Napoleon annexed the Papal States. Remember, he'd already shown the Pope that the crown was not the gift of the Pope. Pope Pius VII excommunicated Napoleon. Now, remember, in the past, that had been a terribly powerful weapon. The Pope, you remember, excommunicated Henry the, what was it, seventh, I think, of Germany. And, well, it just simply took him off the throne. He had to come to where the Pope was at Canossa and humbly begged for forgiveness, and the Pope kept him standing outside the castle, barefooted in the snow, for practically a day before he'd let him in. In a country whose people were Catholic, The interdict upon the nation, or excommunication of the king, was a terrifically serious thing, because when the population were substantially all Catholic, they were forbidden, under pain of eternal damnation, to recognize that they owed any loyalty to the excommunicated king. They couldn't even deliver food for him to eat. They could have no dealings with one who had been excommunicated by the church. So the Pope thought he had a terrific weapon against Napoleon. Napoleon simply arrested and imprisoned the Pope until he signed a treaty recognizing Napoleon's conquest of the Papal States. So if you've listened to some preacher telling you that the Catholic Church is about to gain worldwide dominion, why, that's another of these foolish ideas. Well, Russia had already turned against Napoleon, was intriguing with all the nations of Eastern Europe to turn against him, giving the promise of Russian military assistance. So in 1812, Napoleon attempted the conquest of Russia. This was certainly the greatest military disaster in history. He raised his grand army, an army of 500,000 men. And they didn't have much fighting to do till they got to the Russian borders, because remember, he pretty much had the nations of Eastern Europe under his control. But as they got into Russia, that was a different thing. He captured Moscow September 14th in the year 1812. And beginning the following day, the city was set afire, and it burned to complete destruction, a four-day conflagration. Well, this really was total irremediable disaster. Winter coming on, he didn't even have the houses of the city in which he could keep his troops sheltered from Russian winter storms. There was no food, and he couldn't live off the country, foraging off that, because the Russians used a very thorough scorched earth policy. What they couldn't carry away out of his reach, they destroyed. Neither could he bring supplies hundreds of miles from Europe, because he didn't have the forces back there to bring them, and of course they were subject to guerrilla warfare every inch of the way. So he began a retreat, beginning middle of October, and October through December was his retreat back into Central Europe. Well, his army had almost no food. Their uniforms were not heavy enough for the terrific Russian and Polish winter, and they were harassed by guerrilla bands all the time. The exact number of his losses isn't known, but it was between 80 and 90% of all those 500,000 men that he took into Russia. The greatest military disaster that the Romans ever suffered, the Battle of Cannae, when they suffered a terrific defeat at the hands of Hannibal's forces, was not as bad as this. So in 1814, April 12th, Napoleon abdicated. Now that his army was lost, why, of course, the nations of Europe that had been conquered began rising against him, and, of course, Britain supplying them with munitions and, to some extent, troops and that sort of thing, he was forced off the throne. He was banished to Elba, a little island off the Italian coast. So, remember, his empire began in 1804. It ended in 1814, just 10 years. Now, even Alexander, whose empire was considered very short-lived, his empire lasted for 13 years. Napoleon only 10, so remember what it said? When he cometh, he must continue a short space. This, of all empires in history worthy of that name, this is the shortest-lived of the lot. Napoleon returned to France March 1st, 1815, trying to regain his throne. And indeed, he was received with considerable popular enthusiasm, raised an army of sorts, but he was defeated at Waterloo between June 12th and 18th. So this 100 days attempt to regain his throne is no part of his empire. He never succeeded in gaining the throne, so the end of it is 1814, not 1815. They banished him again to the island of St. Helena off the African coast, and there he died some 5 or 6 years later. But remember now, an empire which covers all of the continent of Europe is certainly one worthy to be ranked with the previous six. And there's no doubt that Napoleon is identified as the seventh head of the beast. Well, that takes in the seven heads. Now, what about the beast itself? Well, as I said, it can't be the Catholic Church, because John was told in the year 94 that this beast previously was, and of course the Catholic Church didn't exist for centuries after that. It can't be Rome, because John was told the beast is not in his day, and Rome was at the height of its power and glory at that time. Now, the final reappearance of this beast as the eighth cannot be a revival of the Roman Empire under Mussolini to rule 3.5 years, as so many of these well-meaning but stupid people preached for a long time. That was Herbert W. Armstrong's great theme song, you know, that Mussolini was going to revive the Roman Empire and rule the world for 3.5 years. Well, anybody that thinks it's going to be a revival of Rome might as well take Mussolini along with it. They're equally dead. Well, we are told that the beast itself would be the eighth empire and would be of the seven, of a similar nature. Well, the fact that this one beast had the characteristics of all four that John saw, and indeed we see this was all seven of the world empires, it shows they all were of that same satanic nature. The beast is red, like the dragon, Edomite Jew controlled. The dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. So, before any of these empires were, it goes back to the old direct satanic rule that was in force in Adam's time. You remember Adam wasn't up against the great world empires that he had to contend with. He was up against the world empire of Satan himself. Now, John was told in his time it is not, because at that time Satan was not ruling directly. He was ruling through the series of world empires to whom he had given authority. You remember, you read that Satan took Jesus Christ up onto a mountain. And it said he showed him in a moment of time all the kingdoms of the earth, the empires, and said, "These are mine, and I give them to whom I will. And if you will fall down and worship me, I'll give all these to you." And you remember, Jesus Christ did not deny that. He didn't say, "Are you trying to kid me? You don't have any power over these." He told Satan, "Get thee behind me, Satan. And it is written, thou shalt worship only Yahweh thy God." But it's recognition again, even by Jesus Christ, that all these world empires were examples of the satanic power. Well, the direct satanic rule of the world then is to reappear after the end of the seven world empires. And of course, Napoleon's gone, century and a half. The seven were bad, the eighth will be worse. Now, there's one little parenthetical thing we might throw in here. The beast, it says, will finally destroy Great Babylon. In the 17th chapter of Revelation, we're going into that in more detail later as we come to it, but I picked it up here to show we're dealing with the same beast as in the 13th chapter. The beast had seven heads with 10 horns. The woman riding on the beast, it said, had a name written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great. So, the whole Babylonian system, religious, economic, and political, is summed up then in this woman. And again, of course, you know how many of these fanatics not only say the beast was the Catholic Church, but also the woman was the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church is one phase only of the satanic Babylonian system, the religious phase, nothing else. But we're told in the 17th chapter that these 10 horns will hate this Babylonian system, the woman riding on the beast, and that they will destroy her. Now, what we jokingly call our civilization today is nevertheless this Babylonian system. And the troubles we have are the direct product of it being Babylonian. You have the brutal, tyrannical character of the Babylonian political system. You have the people misled and led away from proper worship of the one true God by the religious phase of Babylon. And the economic phase is bringing us to destruction under the Jewish-owned and operated Federal Reserve Bank. Now, we see this same thing, which is the only civilization we have at the moment, which makes us nervous when it's threatened. We see it now threatened by destruction from within. Right now, while Russia is getting plenty of rockets and hydrogen bombs ready, Russia figures she isn't going to have to use them because the forces of destruction from within will destroy us. Which, of course, is according to their Marxist theory, and while it has a great measure of truth in it, not because it's Marxist, but because of factors in the Bible that they don't know about. So, here we have the drug peddlers and the poor, stupefied youths that are taking the drugs. with or without drugs, you have these loathsome hippie things. And, of course, the general left-wing takeover of the youth. Because it's been 50 years since they were educated. In the last 50 years, they haven't received an education. They've received merely brainwashing and indoctrination. The people that received an education in this country today are maybe 50 is too much, or should have said 40, but the people who got an education are all 60 or over. So now, you have all these forces threatening to topple and destroy our civilization. And do you notice what loathsome beasts they are? Look at these hippie types. You can't call anything like that human. In fact, it's an insult to the animals to call them animals or beasts. In this 13th chapter of Revelation, verses 11 to 17, we run into another beast now, and this is a little tougher to figure out. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lion, and he spoke as a dragon. And he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Well, the same people who have decided that the first beast was the Catholic Church also, of course, tell you that the second beast likewise is the Catholic Church. And it's quite evident that the Catholic Church alone cannot fulfill the things that are said about this second beast. Now, it's true that the Catholic Church pretends to be a lamb, but it speaks as a dragon. But then, that's not the only thing that carries on that sort of pretense. But now the creation of the image of the first beast, which this second beast brings about, does not fit the Catholic Church. Remember that the revived Holy Roman Empire was not the creation of an image of the first beast. It was simply the healing of the deadly wound of one head only of the first beast. And secondly, the Holy Roman Empire didn't perform the things that we're told here about the image of the first beast. It didn't exercise any more tyranny than any of the other empires did, and it didn't fill this at all.